Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
The people, they're always courting and flattering and bribing. They depend on the people believing every tale they tell them to buy every shoddy package of goods they offer for sale. I have witnessed, I think, nearly all of the television programs made about the BNP. And I cannot think of one single program, or one maybe, the Scottish Eye was reasonably fair. The others, they all contained at least one lie. Only last week, we had this program on the Southern Region TV, facing south. They dragged up some character. Of course, you never saw his face. You just saw his silhouette. He spoke in a northern accent, but it wasn't a northern accent that I can recognize of any of our northern members. And he told the TV cameras that we had put him up to making attacks on synagogues, on Asian mosques, and all the rest of it. He told them that presumably I, and presumably the other leaders of the BNP, had put him up to this. We know that it's a damnable lie. They didn't even come to us and ask for our comment upon it. They simply put it over without us having a chance to refute. And that was one small example of their lies. They depend, after all their failures, all their mishaps, the ruin they've made in this country, they depend on the people to believe their lies. And that is the only way that they're going to stay in power for much longer. But now, here in Britain, after years of surrender of every vital British national interest and every vital British asset, after one capitulation after another, after giving in to the black mobs in our cities, after giving in to the gunmen of the IRA, after years of showing nothing but flabbiness and weakness in the face of rising crime in this country, after all this, they have at last found something. That they're going to act firmly. They've at last found something for which they're going to be strong. They're going to be decisive. They're sending in the tanks. They're sending in the military aircraft. They're sending in the warships. They're sending in troops. Some troops that may be called upon to die. And for what? To protect some little tin pot country in the Middle East in a quarrel that is none of Britain's business and isn't worth the life of one single British soldier. Was controlled by one group of Arabs or another group of Arabs, they still had to sell us their oil at that prices that were competitive enough to dissuade us from buying the oil elsewhere. Why is it always that the guardians of democracy behave like jellyfish when it comes to protecting Britain's interests, but are prepared to send men to fight and die to protect foreign interests? Why is it, my friends, they're always prepared to do that? Prepared to launch a military operation that will cost billions of pounds when they can't afford enough money for British factories, British hospitals, British railways, British schools? Have you ever heard such lunacy in your life? And yet not only the government, but all the parties of opposition, Neil Kinnock, Barry Ashton, and the rest of them, they're all behind men to send forces to the Middle East. They all want British forces to be sent in and British lives to be risked. But is it really to defend Kuwait or Saudi Arabia? Is it to back one group of Arabs against another group of Arabs? Or is it for some deep reason? Is it? Dare I mention the possibility? Is it to defend Israel? Is it to defend and protect the interests of the Jews? If so, it won't be the first time that British servicemen have marched to war in a Jewish quarrel. Not the first time. Poor Tommy Atkins, as so often in history, he knows not in whose cause he is asked to put his life on the line. Well, years ago, we decided to take up the struggle against this system. And we knew when we took up that struggle that the fight would be long and hard. We knew that there would be heartbreaking times, and there were the heartbreaking years of the 1980s, when we seemed to be getting almost nowhere. And comrades, I shall never forget those who stood side by side with me in those very difficult years of the formative time of our movement. But at last, with the coming of 1990, with the dawning of a new decade, and over the not-so-distant horizon, the prospect of a new century, at last, this nation is starting to listen to us. I've mentioned the omens, the upsurge in membership, the greater attendance at our big events, our greater votes. Now, why is it that we are now starting to break through? I'll tell you. Because a revolution is happening. A revolution is happening all over the world. Because that false, prefabricated, shallow world that was constructed by the profiteers of 1945, the catastrophe of 1939-45, that whole world is now collapsing in ruins, and it's a damn good thing for let us hasten its collapse. Communism collapse. We've seen the end of the Cold War, which always was no more than a phony war. We've seen the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and there are more collapses to come, because that's only the start. That's only the start. Soon after the collapse of communism is going to come the collapse of another unworkable system. It will be the collapse of capitalism. Standing here, let me make it clear that I do not mean the ordinary independent private producer who controls his own firm and renders valuable goods or services to the community and makes a profit out of those services. That is not what I mean by capitalism. What I mean when I talk about capitalism is the sharks of the city. What I mean is the Saunders, the Ronsons, the Lions, the Pounds, and the rest of the crooks who make money out of nothing by speculating and by swindling other people. That is what I mean by the coming collapse of capitalism. Isn't it absurd that you can sit in an office in the City of London, buy a telephone on one hand and a computer on the other hand, and you can make a few calculations and a few telephone calls to Tokyo, New York, Paris, or wherever, and you can make a million in a matter of hours without contributing a single sweat of your brow to the prosperity and the wealth of this country? Isn't that wrong? And that is what I mean by capitalism. I don't mean the honest-to-goodness private producer. And I believe that that capitalist order is going to collapse just as certainly as the communist order has collapsed.
because we know, don't we, that ever since 1917, the two have been blood brothers, buddies together in the same bed. Of capitalism is going to come the collapse of two more of the sacred cows of our own system, multiracialism and internationalism. Because for all these years they have been pulling the wool over the eyes of the people, trying to tell them that racism is a sin, that racism is evil. And all around us, in the cities of our country, Birmingham, London, Manchester, Liverpool, Glasgow, elsewhere, Bristol, Nottingham, Leicester, the facts of life are showing that multiracialism cannot work and will fail. Today is that a whole tide is sweeping across this world, burying for all time the false world that was created in 1945. And everywhere in this new world, that is starting to take shape at the end of this century and is going to be the world of the next century, everywhere in this world, nationalism is on the march again. We have seen it rise in France. We have seen it rise in America through the successes of David Duke. We have seen it rise in Germany and elsewhere. It has always been there in Japan, which is the reason why Japan is the most successful nation in the world today. And we are a little bit behind, but we are starting to move too. And this meeting, and this year of development by our movements is a proof that here, the slow to anger British people are at last starting to be angry. It's happening here. It is happening here through you, through your work, through your sacrifice, through your dedication, and through the sheer tide of events that is sweeping over us all, showing that what we have stood for all of these dark years of failure and setback has been right all the time, and is today the only way out if Britain is to live again. So I end today by a thought on the words of the police commissioner for London, Sir Peter Imbert, who has told the meeting of the Jewish Board of Deputies, only the other day he said, "I am determined to stamp out racism in London." Well, I can tell them all today that he is going to fail, and they are going to fail everywhere. Country are the stirrings of a reborn people, a people who have been trained.
Welcome to Voice of Albion, John Tyndall, Part 11. You just heard the second part of the John Tyndall BNP speech in 1990. I know 20 minutes is a bit long for an intro, but I thought I'd include it because very good speech, I'm sure you'll agree, and there's not all that much in the way of John Tyndall speeches during the 90s available. Chapter 13, Beyond Capitalism and Socialism. When we look at today's economic scene, two facts stand out above all others, and both are inextricably related. The first is that entity popularly described as the world economy is in a state of total chaos. Every week sees an escalation of trade war. The neat and pretty rules devised by the pioneers of the post-1945 economic era to govern the trading relations between nations lie in tatters, either disregarded with contempt or the subject of heated arguments in the interminable international conferences how to thrash out an agreed formula for the continuation of the world trade system. Even more chaotic still is the state of world finance, with many nations sunk in a trap of completely unpayable debt, and the world's leading bankers making an ominous prediction of a financial collapse on a scale that would make that of 1929 seem like a minor hiccup. The second fact JT states is the deep-rooted nature of Britain's economic decline, for this is not merely the kind of decline that can be depicted as the normal downward turn in an economic cycle. The decline has proceeded almost uninterruptedly for the past 100 years, though in the most recent 2 decades it has accelerated to the point of facing us with the imminent threat of extinction as a manufacturing nation. The British economic system has, for as long as any of us can remember, been the subject of deep national introspection. Britain has had, after all, more of the ingredients of economic success than almost any nation. Her lead in the Industrial Revolution was aided by the existence of a population with an unsurpassed talent for economic activity, including an exceptionally high level of manufacturing inventiveness and skill, combined with abundant reserves of the most vital energy source of that time, coal. Together with these assets, we had, then, access to an empire of boundless resources and wealth, able to provide us with almost every raw material we needed, and with a huge internal market for our manufactured produce. Of course, JT continues, we could not expect to maintain indefinitely the domination of the world market for manufacturers that we had up to about the middle of the 19th century. But that fact should in no way have brought about an inevitable decline, only an adjustment of trade practices. With this adjustment, JT contends, we would have had no fewer advantages than Germany and France, and later Japan, and in fact, much greater advantages than any of those nations for as long as we held onto our imperial power. And yet, our economic performance is a good way inferior to that of France, and many, many miles inferior to those of Germany and Japan. These claims are based essentially upon recent percentage growth comparisons between Britain and these countries, at a time when the latter's growth rates have slowed down. If this decline is not the product of any disadvantage in the way of resources, either human or natural, it has to be the product of bad leadership, organisation and policy. Indeed, of the fact that, for the whole of the time in question, we have simply not had anything that could qualify to be called a policy, JT asserts. On the socialist failure to provide an alternative to the failed capitalist system, JT writes, it failed because right at the start it made 3 cardinal errors that were at the root of the failure of its predecessor. Each of these errors originating in the legacy of liberal institutions and ideology that our socialist pioneers took into their baggage. JT states the first was that while these socialists called, in principle, for government regulation of economic forces in the service of the general good, they never understood or accepted the need for political institutions that would make that regulation effective. While proclaiming their radicalism, in quotes, in respect to the economic and social change for which they stood, they showed themselves to be dyed-in-the-wool reactionaries in their reverence for the old and failed political party system. All was to be talk, talk, and more talk. Whereas socialism spoke in theory of dynamic reform, in practice it brought to the top men incapable of dynamism in anything, and it saddled them with a system that stifled all dynamic impulse, even in the unlikely event of anyone emerging who possessed it. JT then quotes Sir Oswald Mosley as an example of the latter. Early in the 1930s, Mosley produced a programme for dealing with unemployment that incorporated a bold call for the mobilisation of all national resources in a policy of economic development that represented the first ever effort to get to grips with reality in a labour market party previously lost in holy and impractical dreams. Socialism rejected Mosley, and with him the one supreme opportunity to overcome the crisis of that age. Instead, it preferred the dreary cavalcade of cowardice, inertia, stunted thinking and empty wind, as represented by MacDonald, Thomas, Snowden, Lansbury and the rest of the feeble creatures, feeble figures who shuffled across the socialist scene in the inexorable procession to slump, poverty and war, and in 1940, defeat. quick note on Mosley. If you read his autobiography, My Life, you'll hear how the far left in the period John Tyndall refers to smeared Mosley as an aristocrat. Although he was that, he did care greatly for working people. As JT points out, the left dismissed his economic reforms to the cost of the poor. There is a PDF of Mosley's book, My Life, which I'll link to on the show page. I'll just play a short clip now from 1930, when Mosley was a Labour MP. Mosley was MP for Smethwick between 1926 and 1931. The clip is entitled Oswald Mosley, 1930, Employment.
Are you going to talk about unemployment today?
Why, of course. It is the one problem that really matters today. We live in a period in which politicians are not very popular. And believe me, you have my sympathy. Politicians are regarded as people who have learnt to talk, but not to act. And you demand action, and rightly demand it, in dealing with unemployment. We live in a period when Britain can only survive by vigour and by action. We have resources of intellect, of energy, of craftsmanship, of skill, second to none in the world. But those resources must be mobilized for a great effort of a united nation. To do that, government and statesmen must take their courage in their hands.
JT states that the second cardinal error committed by socialist pioneers was their embrace of internationalism, failing to see that it was that very internationalism that had been the main factor in making the capitalist economy unworkable. They set about on the same disastrous road. British economic prosperity and progress were to be pursued not through reliance on national resources and national effort, but through fortuitous dreams and abstractions expressed in such phrases as the brotherhood of man and workers of the world unite. Finally, socialism, JT goes on, failed completely to get to grips with the other evil that had attended the career of the capitalist system, the tyranny of finance. Not finance as the necessary handmaiden of productive economic activity, but finance as the economy's master, placing all the productive forces into the grip of the bankers and usurers and making money the arbiter of all that was possible for industry rather than materials, machines, skills and work. Socialism, while breaking much rhetorical wind over the diabolism of the big bankers and financiers, produced nothing whatever that was practical to free the economy from their fraud. Eventually settled down to a routine of economics which left the powers of finance every bit as much in control as before. Socialism thus became, behind all its brave rhetoric, just another tool of the forces of economic reaction, incorporating all the worst features of the capitalist disorder, but without its dynamism, its enterprise, and its incentive to effort. To this nonsense, socialism added another piece of similar folly, The idea that all men were created equal in their inherent capabilities and only differed in their performance on account of inequalities in economic status and education, followed latter, of course, by the attempt to extend this equality mania to the world's widely contrasting racial groups, resulting in the misery we now see throughout the length and breadth of Africa and elsewhere, where the decolonisation process, eagerly promoted by all progressive opinion, was carried out in the wake of World War II. Thus has Britain been governed since the Industrial Revolution, whether by parties of the left or the right, by approaches to economy which reject the very first basics, and which, therefore, at no point could be dignified by the description of a policy. The capitalists of the 19th and early 20th century periods have taken a great deal of punishment from historians and political ideologues, and no doubt in some individual cases this has been deserved. What is not often taken into account, however, is that they had to operate within a system which imposed upon them two vital disadvantages in the way of raising the pay and conditions of their employees to a decent living level. The first of these was a banking and financial system which, since the setting up of the Bank of England in 1694, had given the bankers the power to create the nation's money by means of the fractional reserve regulation under which bank loans could be made to a total several times in excess of real monetary assets. By this process, the new money needed to fuel an expanding economy came into existence, to ever-increasing degrees as a debt owing with interest to the banks. This practice gave the banks increasing power over the economy, with a growing portion of the wealth created being yielded to them as tribute, for no essential service to the economy that could not better be undertaken by other means. Industry inevitably got into increasing debt, with an ever greater portion of its income going to service this debt, as was also the case with government. The second disadvantage suffered by industry was the necessity for it to survive in world markets by means of competitive prices. The raising of wages to the desired level would have resulted in British goods being priced out of these markets. This tendency was further accentuated when the Orient began to become industrialised, largely with the aid of finance from the City of London, which knew then, as it knows now, no national boundaries or patriotic loyalties. From that time on, cheap coolie labour enabled Orientals to dump goods around the world at prices with which British manufacturers could not possibly compete, except by keeping wages down at a level well below that required for the various living standards. I'm going to play another short Oswald Mosley clip entitled Oswald Mosley on Globalisation. The date I found for it is 1964, which that surprised me a little bit, but it may well be correct, as Mosley formed a successor to the British Union of Fascists after the war called the Union Movement. Officially, he led the Union Movement till his death in 1980. The last election Mosley stood in was in 1966, and he wrote his autobiography in 1968, so that date may well be right. So I'll play the Mosley clip talking about globalisation.
Africa, like the other poor devils in China, India and Japan, a great new field for sweatshops to be opened up, so that these new industries which we're creating in Britain today will be destroyed as the old industries were. Simplified, rationalized machinery with a few white surveyors, and then the masses of cheap colored labor torn off the land and taken into the sweatshops to work and labor and cough their guts out with tuberculosis until they too are thrown on the scrap heap of the sweatshops. Is that worthy of Britain? Is that to be the future of Europe? And is this competition to be organized within our European brotherhood, bringing in these sweat fields in Africa into our Europe civilization, so that the financial power in one European country can use it against the financial power in another? All the great financial central power of the world, now shifted from the City of London to Wall Street, New York, shall be able, on the mass of money, of wealth and of power which it brings to it, again and again to exert its influence in politics, until, as you see today, it is childish nonsense to say that a British government rules Britain It's nothing to do with British government or the British people. The government of the world is the financial government, the power of money and of money alone.
JT continues, had Britain had anything resembling an economic policy, our reaction to these developments would have been simple and obvious. From the moment that it became clear that our easy and unquestioned world manufacturing supremacy was at an end, and that henceforth we would face in world markets stiff competition, often of a kind impossible to match, we should have elected for a nationalist policy, shutting manufacturing foreign goods out from the British and imperial markets and giving monopoly to those markets to British industry and to the young industries of the dominions as they developed. Wages then could have been steadily raised, JT states, as would have been possible in an industrialised system geared mainly to the domestic and imperial markets where cutthroat competition would have been absent. With the rise in wages would have come an immense rise in domestic and imperial purchasing power, thereby aiding the further expansion of industry in a market that would have been assured. But none of this was done, JT points out. It was not done because British economic affairs were the slaves of liberalism and internationalism. There was never a policy, only drift. There was never leadership or government, only the continued deference of government towards economic forces. And these forces, in large part, stood to lose by such a policy. City of London Finance, which had invested enormously in foreign economies, could only obtain its dividends by allowing these countries in which it had invested to export their goods to Britain at the expense, if necessary, of home and dominion producers. And City of London Finance always seemed to have necessary pull over every government of whatever party complexion, so that no government was prepared to intervene to protect industries that were our life's blood. JT then refers to Joseph Chamberlain's tariff reform proposals he mentioned in an earlier chapter. He reminds us they were rejected. He writes, most certainly had Britain had a mechanism of government that enabled political leadership to prevail over economic forces, the tariff reform proposals would have been adopted. Precisely the same fate as befell tariff reform also befell the proposals put forward in the Mosley Memorandum presented nearly three decades later. Again, liberalism and internationalism held sway. Within the kind of national system that would have developed through these reforming movements, the worst abuses of the capitalist system could have been eliminated by the adoption of a high-wage economy geared to home and dominion markets, with an economy which the great leviathans of industry could sustain while remaining profitable and viable. In other words, within a national system, a measure of capitalism could have worked to the benefit of all sections of the population. But within the international system, capitalism was, and is, doomed to go on manifesting the same fundamental weaknesses and abuses, its present legacy to Britain being a massive increase in the legions of those not engaged in full-time work. On foreign investment into Britain, JT writes, elaborate statistics are regularly trotted out to show how much Japanese companies, for instance, favour investment in Britain over investment in the industries of our European neighbours. They neglect to mention that this investment simply has the effect of placing an increasing portion of the British economy under foreign control, with decisions concerning its future being made in foreign boardrooms. JT then quotes the editor of the Observer newspaper, Will Hutton, who wrote in an article on November 17, 1996, "Reliance on inward investment is not a sign of strength, it's a sign of weakness. The reason why foreign and especially Asian multinationals come here is not benign, it is a form of colonisation. Moreover, the attempt to win inward investment is now reaching absurd degrees. The incentives available to foreign companies do locate in Britain are many times greater than those available to British firms. Taxpayers' money is being used in ever greater quantities to ensure our industrial subordination." And Hutton, still speaking of overseas investors, added a little further on, "Bluntly, they see overseas investment as a means of industrial empire. building in which they are the masters, and the British, amongst others, their coolies. I don't know if listeners are familiar with the phrase coolies, but it was first used, I believe, for Indian labourers in the Caribbean. So there wasn't slaves as such, but there was, you know, very low-paid, second-class labourers. That's what coolie means. And a quick note, this situation is worse than 1996. In Birmingham alone, the second city of Britain, Rover, a large manufacturer of cars, has been brought by first the Germans, who wanted the Mini brand. They took the Mini brand and then sold the rest of Rover to the Chinese. That's not me attacking Germans for doing that. I'm blaming the British government for not keeping Rover British and all those jobs. The quintessentially British Jaguar car brand has been brought by the Indian billionaire who owns the Tata Corporation. Many people get their electric and gas from Enpower, which is German, or EDF, which is French. The Rover plant actually is quite near where I live, and it has a Chinese communist flag now flying on it. Wiki states, in 2009, EDF Energy took control of the UK nuclear generator, British Energy, buying share capital from the government. This made EDF Energy one of the UK's largest generators, as well as the largest distribution network operator. EDF is wholly owned by the French state-owned EDF SA. On the Indian Tata Group, a few acquisitions of theirs. February 2000, the Tetley Tea Company was purchased for $407 million. March 2004, Daewoo Commercial Vehicle Company was acquired for $102 million. November 2006, Ritz-Carlton in Boston was purchased for $170 million by the Tata Group. And in March 2008, Jaguar Cars and Land Rover was purchased for $2.3 billion. And in May 2008, Piaggio Aero Industries in Italy was purchased, no figure available. Wiki states, Tata Group is an Indian multinational conglomerate company headquartered in Mumbai, India. So things have gotten a lot worse than they was in 1998 when John Tyndall wrote The 11th Hour. JT continues. The extent to which recent British governments have permitted and encouraged, and indeed, as Hutton has pointed out, financed foreign investment in British industry, far from indicating economic success, indicates economic failure. It is a confession that the British economy itself, the inheritor of the legacy of the workshop of the world, is too feeble itself to provide the money and the expertise to set up British factories to make the required goods and provide the required jobs. Our rulers have subjected Britain to the ultimate depths of degradation by this practice, which has often involved the importation of Japanese managerial staff who have been brought here to show British workers, who are only the descendants of the people who started the world's first industrial revolution, how to carry out production efficiently. Watching more and more of the British economy fall into state hands of foreign ownership is like watching a great estate built up and maintained by generations of a proud family, sold off because the present heir just does not have what it takes to keep it going, though the new owners may condescend to allow him, his wife and their brood to continue living on a part of the premises in return for rent. The late Sir James Goldsmith, in his book The Trap, used an apt metaphor to describe this process. But when a foreign nation does direct its excess cash to a nation suffering a deficit, that money usually returns in the form of investment in assets or in fixed interest debt. Those assets thereby become the property of a foreign owner, and their earnings flow to that owner. To illustrate the consequences, imagine a game of poker in which you lose more cash than you possess. Instead of paying in cash, you hand over ownership of your house and you continue to live in it as a tenant paying rent. Are we seriously to believe that such a transaction has had a nil effect on your financial position? JT then talks of another downside to foreign ownership and not being self-reliant in industry. Even where ownership by the foreign multinationals does not result in the closure of factories and the consignment of their labour forces to the scrap heap, it is liable often to lead a consolidation process in which factories in Britain, instead of turning out the whole product, produce only parts of it, with the remainder being made in factories belonging to the same conglomerate but located overseas. This may, from the standpoint of the owners, be an expedient division of labour, but from the standpoint of British industry, it simply further undermines self-sufficiency and increases vulnerability. The process has become advanced in the motor industry, of which I have spoken, and the results have not been to the benefit of British motor manufacturing capacity. What happens if a strike abroad holds up the supply of parts needed here? What happens if we find ourselves in a war and we cannot produce motor vehicles for war use without the cooperation of foreigners who may not be on our side? This latter question is not put frivolously, J.T. adds. The strategic dangers of an industrial machine that does not permit a self-sufficient military capacity has been amply demonstrated in both the major wars of this century. In each contingency, Britain found herself without a number of the essential components needed for arms manufacture and had to import these, mainly from America, before home production was organised to meet the need, and the latter never was accomplished totally. JT then quotes Corelli Barnett, who pinpointed this shortcoming in the collapse of British power when describing our dilemma in World War I. Barnett: there were but few light engineering factories with lines of semi-automatic lathes and other machines to be converted for finishing shell cases. Few precision industries like mechanical toy and clockmaking to switch to the mass manufacture of finely accurate shell fuses. Before the war, Britain had imported German toys and clocks. Thus, in 1915 and 16, Britain was forced to create a light engineering industry. This attempt immediately uncovered another deficiency. There was no modern machine tool industry capable of producing sophisticated machines for the new production lines. Modern machine tools had been imported from Germany and the United States before the war. This deficiency was particularly appalling because the machine tool industry was the key to every kind of modern large-scale production, in war as well as in peace. Shells, fuses, aircraft, vehicles, and all sorts of equipment and instrumentation. It was the purchase of American, Swedish, and Swiss machine tools that prevented a total breakdown of the British effort to create new industries between 1914 and 16. Nevertheless, shortage of machine tools exercised a pervasive throttling effect, not only on shell production, but also, for example, on engines and aircraft. JT writes, government must act not only to achieve self-sufficiency for Britain in all manufactured products, but to restore industry in Britain to British ownership and control, for only within the framework of such a policy can there be any effective leadership and organisation of industry towards national recovery. JT then talks of the banking system at length, and calls for private banks to be relieved of their privilege of creating money and loaning out money they don't have. He calls for government to be in charge of creating money. He writes, we must not forget that a huge portion of taxation today goes to meeting the services of the national debt, that is to say, the interest on all the monies that governments have borrowed in the past under the old fraudulent system. With the methods advocated, JT contends that the national debt could be eventually eliminated. Legitimate creditors could be paid off. On the other hand, debts incurred with the banks by means of the fractional reserve system of lending should be repudiated. The same principle would apply to debts around the necks of local government. JT calls his doctrine economic nationalism. The doctrine advocates the mobilisation and organising by national government of all the nation's economic resources, public and private, in a coordinated national programme for the achievement of national prosperity, strength and power, and in pursuit of goals of economic development that are conceived not in four or five years, but 50 years ahead of time. The doctrine strives to take back the nation's economic future out of the arena of cheapjack party politics with their daily jostling for fragmentary factional advantage and elevate it to a level at which it commands the selfless dedication of a united people, working for aims which, though they do indeed include material betterment, do not make that a be-all and end-all. Aims which include national security, freedom and honour, national and racial health, and the preservation of the best of national tradition and culture. In putting forward these aims, JT writes, "I have stressed, and I stress again, that no worthwhile economic policy can be carried out without there being present the requisite political power and will. Economic reform and political reform must therefore be seen as two vital components in a single policy of national regeneration." He concludes, "Let there be no doubt about it, the new economics will not be achieved by means of the old politics. The necessary political instrument must be forged before the desired economic changes become possible. Politics must lead and not be led by economic forces." That's the end of chapter 13. John Tyndall spoke a lot about the Japanese, because bearing in mind he's writing in 1998, I missed a lot of that out because Japan are not what they was in 1998. But he also spoke about the European Union a lot and that we shouldn't be in it. It was a big chapter, so I had to leave those things out. Next Sunday we'll do chapter 14, and it's titled A New Land and a New People. To stay with the economic theme, I'll play it with a speech by Richard Edmonds he gave at the London Forum in October 2012. The speech is entitled "The West is Bankrupt." Thanks for listening. See you next week. Take care. 14 words.
He is perhaps the one person who is universally respected by all nationalists in Britain.
How much am I paying you for so much?
Not Griffin.
He's a person who I think you all know. So without further ado, please join your hands together. We give a warm round of applause for Richard Edmonds.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, fellow patriots, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the warm applause. My speech is going to be on an entirely different plane to that of the two earlier speakers. I'm not going to talk about genetics. I'm not going to talk about the diversity of the genetics. I'm not going to talk about race futurism. I'm going to talk about the fact that the whole Western world is bankrupt. In particular, all the governments of the Western world are bankrupt. And I can tell you that when we was waiting at our first rendezvous point at that tube station by that pleasant park there, I was looking at all the tourists walking around eating their ice creams and eating their burgers and all that, and I was looking at them and thinking how happy they look eating their ice creams and their burgers. And I thought to myself, little do they know, the whole lot of them are bankrupt, and the bailiffs will be calling very, very soon. But that's not true of them personally. It's certainly true of their governments. The Greek government has gone bankrupt. The government of Portugal has gone bankrupt. The government of Southern Ireland has gone bankrupt at an earlier stage. And that is going to be that will be the fate. Every government in the Western world, including the British government, the German government, and the government of the United States of America, they are all facing bankruptcy. The whole lot. Listen, I'm going to quote an authoritative source here, like the earlier speaker. These are the words aren't coming from me. I'm going to quote here the editorial at the Times. On the day following the last general election, the general election of the year 2010, the Times printed this editorial whilst the votes were still being counted, but they knew the results. The Times said, well, how it works. The Times said, Britain is in the grip of a brewing, ongoing economic crisis. The opening words were contemptuous of the politicians. The opening words of this editorial on the day following the last general election, were openly contemptuous of the politicians, with the phrase they use in their first sentence, "The rhetorical flight of the election campaigns are now over." Second sentence, "The burden of government awaits." Third sentence, the perilous state of the economy and the public finances overweighs everything else. The perilous state of the public finances overwhelms everything else. The fact is, we're talking here, I'm going to talk about Britain, because I'm a British person living in Britain, but what I'm going to say applies to every Western government. The British government spends up here, and its income is down here. And there is a huge deficit, and each year, the British government, in supporting our basic standard of living, in keeping the infrastructure of this country going, the British government, each year, on our behalf, borrows £130 billion. Now, a billion is 1,000 million. And the British government borrows £130,000 million a year to support our basic standard of living. To pay for the pensions, to pay for the health bill, the education bill, the defence, the local government. Here is the public expenditure of the last year. The British government spent on our behalf £700 billion on our behalf, and had to borrow to balance its books £130 billion. In fact, the British government, like every Western government, I'll tell you, I'll go for a slight tangent here. I've given this speech a number of times. I used to be a member of another party, a British Nationalist Party. I'm no longer a member of that British Nationalist Party. I'm now a member of another British Nationalist Party. That's the state of chaos we're in. Well, that's a fact. We're in a state of chaos. I'm not going to talk about the problems of British nationalism. I'm going to talk about the problems of the British people living in a country that... should I say effing well bankrupt, maybe? So phrase your friends of ladies. The fact is, we're bankrupt. And people have been shocked. People have no idea. These are nationalists who give their minds to politics. That the British government borrows millions of pounds, billions of pounds each week just to keep this show going. In fact, the British government, like all Western governments, is in a classic debt spiral, in that we borrow billions each week, and every week the British government has to pay out £1 billion each week just to service the debt of all the vast sums that the British government has borrowed over the years. In fact, the British government spends more money servicing the debt than it does on defence, for example. In spite of the fact we've got troops fighting these, you know, godforsaken wars in godforsaken parts of the world, the British government spends more money on servicing the debt than it does in paying for the defence. And the fact is that these sums are enormous. You have to factor them down to make them real. And I've done that for you. An obliging nationalist. And my friends say nice things about me. So, the facts are this. For every £5 that the British government spends on benefits, pensions, health, education, I'm reading out the list here from the budget, defence, local government, law and order, the police, for every £5 that they spend, £4 is raised conventionally by taxes, VAT, and the fifth pound is borrowed. The fifth pound is borrowed. And it is this enormous scale of borrowing that caused the Times to talk about Britain is in the grip of a brewing economic crisis. This came out 2 years ago, following the last general election. The perilous state of the economy and the public finances. Now, the only way to understand these vast sums is to work them down. What does all this mean for the average British family? What does it mean for your families and for my families? the fact that the government, our government, has to borrow £130 billion in 1 year just to keep this show going. What does it mean? Well, I'll do the sum for you. If we take it, we're talking here, an average British family. Now, I'm going to tell you, keep the sum very, very simple. I'm going to say that an average British family consists of husband, wife, and three children. Or alternatively, in the modern age, husband, wife, two children, and one dependent adult. We live as families, and I'm going to tell you that my average family, the average family, consists of five individuals. If you then do the sum and say that 55 million Britons, forgetting the foreigners, I'm going to come to the foreigners in a minute, they're an important factor in all this. Yeah. They're a very important factor in the enormous debts which they, that crowd down at Westminster, have loaded onto our shoulders. But I'll come to the foreigners in a second. If one says there's a family of, the average family consists of five individuals, if you take the population of Britain, of us Britons, about 55 million, that means there's 11 million families in Britain. If you work out what £130,000 million borrowed on behalf of 11 million families works out at, it works out that every family's standard of living, the basic maintenance of the infrastructure, the payment of the pensions, the health service, the defence, it works out that every family in Britain has its basic standard of living supported by this level of government borrowing to the extent of £11,000 a year. Every one of your families, including mine, is supported. Yeah, do the sums. I was in one meeting, and there was a woman there, an intelligent-looking woman, and as I was coming out with all these facts and figures, she was noting them down, and at the end of it, I said, have I got that right? She says, yes, you've got it right. Believe me, these figures are so staggering that I have checked them many, many times before I spoke at Jez's meeting, before I met you lovely ladies and gentlemen. The average, our standard of living, the average family is supported by this enormous amount of £11,000 a year, which is well over £200 a week. If, and in a minute you might see the implications of if for any reason that the British government could no longer go onto the international money markets and borrow this money, then our standard of living, as in Greece, would collapse overnight. Overnight. You may have seen the photograph in the Guardian newspaper about 2 weeks ago. It showed a queue of respectable looking people in Athens, Greece, queuing up for free food. That's what happens when a country goes bankrupt. That's what happens when a government goes bankrupt. I will just go on a slight detour here and put into parentheses, yes, we're talking about the average British family here because we are Britons and we're responsible for this, and this is our country, and if our government goes bankrupt, we'll be bankrupt. But I am not forgetting the presence of these foreigners in our country, and I'm not forgetting that immigration permitting millions of third worlders and other foreigners into our country, and giving these millions of third worlders and other foreigners in our country a first world standard of living is, of course, costing this country a fortune, an absolute fortune. In fact, if this was a more critical speech, I'd say that's a burden put on us deliberately to break our backs, actually. But at the moment, we'll just stick to the finances. Yeah. So, because I agree with every point that Mrs. Linda Miller made first of all. There's a whole number of questions come out of this. Question number one. Where does this money come from that we have to borrow every week? Where? There are two principal sources of this borrowing. One is that the British government borrows vast sums of money from foreigners, from foreign governments. And I'm going to name two sources. Two of the biggest sources of this credit from their point of view and borrowing from our point of view. The first country that Britain borrows vast sums of money from is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia. Yeah, indeed. It's ominous. Because Saudi Arabia paid practically every mosque that was built in Britain is paid for by the government of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, this very extreme Muslim state, pays for most of the mosques that are built in Britain. And the question arises, is the real price in terms of realpolitik, is the real price that the West in general, and Britain in particular, is paying for this access to all this money that we're borrowing from the extreme Muslim state of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Is it in fact the real price that we have to let in millions of Muslims into our country in exchange?
No.
I will remind you of the old saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune. I'm not a British nationalist for nothing, Mr. Chairman. You do understand that. Right, that's that. Right? At your service, ladies and gentlemen. The second source of funding that the British government goes on its knees and grovels for is China. Not just China. The Communist government of the People's Republic of China. In fact, what I could have done, and I omitted to do it, apologies, I did it, I've shown at other meetings, I have a photograph, because Britain is not the only country that has to grovel for this money, grovel. Because when you're in debt, you have to grovel. God help anybody who looks at that £5 note. Yeah, I'll show you a £5 note. I think I've got one. Well, no, I was giving it to Des. Yeah, I'll show you a £10 note. If you've ever been in a situation where that is your last £10 note, nothing too personal here, not on this point, but it's a very unpleasant situation to have to grovel. Now, it's not just the British government that's in this situation, so is the government of the United States of America. And there's a photograph on the internet, which I took down and showed at these meetings. It shows a photograph of the President of the United States of America, a very tall chap, tall and as thin as me, but a different complexion. Okay, well, he's the President of the United States of America. He went over 3 years ago, and with his begging cap, to borrow even more money from Japan, because Japan is a major source of borrowing to the United States of America. And there's a photograph of President Obama, the president of the most militarily most powerful state in the world, and Obama must have practiced for this because I couldn't do it. And there's the little president, the little emperor of Japan, a tiny little guy, and Obama has so practiced, it's called kowtowing in the East, has bent right double. It's an amazing photograph to see. A representative of the most militarily most powerful state in the world begging for money.
Good.
In the East, it's called kowtowing. Next day, Obama went to China and begged money from the president of the Communist government of the People's Republic of China. Now, I can tell you that when the white man, that's the white man, right, when the white man was master of this world, before we destroyed ourselves in two world wars, where's our German speaker, by the way? Where's he gone to?
He's there.
Before the white man destroyed himself in two world wars, when we had an empire, because we conquered the world at one stage, being such a wonderful people, of course, having set up the United States of America en passant, as the French would say, en passant, setting up North America, we then went and built a worldwide empire. How did we build that worldwide empire? When the Chinese gave us a bit of trouble, this is before Sternberg turned up, by the way, based up there in Upper Mongolia, some years before the White Baron turned up, we had troops in China called the Boxer Rebellion. And two British sergeants, were captured by the Chinese. And the Chinese said, kowtow, kowtow. And Rudyard Kipling wrote a famous poem about the two British sergeants who wouldn't kowtow. The Chinese put them in the snake pit. That's the end of them. That's before we had presidents and prime ministers who kowtowed. That's when the white man was still the white man, before we destroyed ourselves in two world wars. However, so we borrow from the China. It's so dangerous and so shameful what's going on here. I'll ask a question. Please allow me. I used to be a school teacher at one time, so you'll allow me to ask questions. What, ladies and gentlemen, now come on, how good are you? What is the largest reservoir in England? I shall take a swig of this lemonade whilst you're thinking it out.
What's the water?
Pure water.
Yeah, it's all good stuff, this. Sorry.
Somebody at Peterborough.
It's further north.
Yeah.
Further north. England. Scotland and Wales are bigger than the reservoir. Anyway, I'll give you the answer. The largest reservoir in England is the Kielder Dam and Reservoir, north of Newcastle.
Yeah.
And when it was built in the 1920s, it was the pride and joy of the British water industry. They were very proud of this dam. The Kielder Reservoir supplies all the water for Newcastle in the whole of the northeast. It even supplies water down to Manchester. Last year, the Chinese bought the Kielder Reservoir. Last year. And this year, the Chinese bought 10% of Thames water. 10% of the water that we drink in London is now owned by the Chinese. The politicians, the traitors, Liblab and Con traitors, who are ruining Britain as their counterparts are ruining every white country in the white world, are so shameless, they're selling the family's silver in form of the very water that we drink. That is dangerous and humiliating. And hardly anybody knows these things. It's only because gents like me, read the Financial Times on your behalf. And then photocopy it in the public library. I don't pay a quid for this thing. I know what a £10 note looks like, and I don't pay a quid for this. I go to the public library. And that's what I find out. So, that is one major source of funding for the British government, is borrowing from countries abroad. The other major funding source is, and I choose my words with great care, the incestuous and very improper relationship between the Bank of England on the one hand and the British government on the other.
Yeah.
In that the Bank of England is producing credit out of nothing in a process called quantitative easing.
Yeah.
It's a very dangerous process because they're creating credit. The Bank of England creates credit out of nothing and then lends it to the British government in a process known as quantitative easing. Now it is very dangerous because it is potentially very inflationary for our government to spend money which somebody has just printed in the printing presses or in the modern world just put so many digits on a computer screen. When this process started, it was a temporary emergency, back in the year, three years ago, 2009, at the height of the banking crisis, when the banking crisis first struck the United States of America, then Britain, then the rest of the white world, when it was seriously feared, 3 years ago, when these major US banks were going bankrupt, Bernstein's and other banks were going bankrupt, and it was seriously feared that the banks would run out of credit. It was seriously feared back then in 2009 that these cash machines would have no notes in them, that the banks would have no notes. And to get over what was regarded or described at the time as a temporary emergency measure, they produced quantitative easing. They produced £75 billion worth of credit. 75 followed by 9 noughts. And somebody, of course, just put it on a computer screen. 759 noughts with a pound sign in front. Because it is potentially so dangerous at creating inflation, a runaway inflation, quantitative easing was meant to be followed by its twin, QE followed by QT, quantitative tightening, to take the credit out of circulation to neutralise the potential effect of inflation. Now, in fact, surprise, quantitative tightening has never been brought about. Never. They have introduced tranche after tranche of quantitative easing, which is now the original 75 billion has now reached 325 billion. Which is £325,000 worth of credit created just like that, out of nothing. And I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I'll do the sum for you. Which I've checked it several times. I had this lady in my audience in Leicestershire 2 years ago checking it all for me. She did it very well. It's nice because each one of us, as we walk around, has got a sort of invisible but very, very real £6,000 worth of on top of our heads. 6,000 over every one of us. 55 million Britons has got £6,000 worth of quantitative easing, rather like a sort of sword of Democles, actually. And every time we go to the shops, every time we buy something, you've got an avalanche, every one of us, of £6,000 rushing down at you in an uncontrolled inflation. That is called quantitative easing. They have no plans to do anything about it. In fact, as we debate here, on Monday or the following Monday, the Bank of England, just a mile or two down the road, is going to announce its big decision. The next tranche of quantitative easing is either going to be another 50 billion, or that's peanuts, as they say in North America. Gee, man, that's peanuts. Think big, man, think big. It's going to be 100 billion. Because 50 billion doesn't have any effect. But the drug it is. They've got to have a bigger fix. And I tell you, these governments are as addicted to debt as some junkie down the road. And we're talking about our government, the British government, the same the German government, or the American government. They are addicted to debt. It is very, very dangerous, and greatly to be deplored. You can see why the Times, which knew a thing or two, talked about Britain being in a very, very dangerous situation. Perilous is the word they used. That's the day after. Never mind the politicians. The rhetorical flight. This is how the editorial starts. The rhetorical flights of the election campaign are over. In other words, ignore the trash. Lib Lab and Con, they're junkies, they're trash. The burden of government waits, the perilous state of the country's finances. I will conclude this and wrap this up. I know it's all been very factual, but you know, it's bread and butter. Bread and butter. Our bread and butter. Think of that queue in Athens. All these respectable people queuing up for loaves of bread. They were giving away loaves of bread in Athens. So the question arises, how did we get into this situation? How did it come about that we need to borrow billions from the communist government of the People's Republic of China? How did that come about? Answer, because the goods that we need and the goods that we buy are practically all made in the cheap labour countries of the Far East. Now, I don't know about you, but my background is as an engineer, and it interests me to see where things are made. I'm in the shops, I look, where is it made? And whether you're talking about television sets or components for computers or knitting needles, practically everything is made in the People's Republic of China. And I'll tell you, even men's underwear is made overseas. And I'll tell you, in case you don't know, because when I buy pants, like everybody else buy pants, I look to see where they're made. And sometimes the pants that I buy are made in Indonesia. Sometimes the pants that I buy, I'm not going to tell you what shop I buy them from, because you might all boo me out the room. Yeah. Boo, you don't buy there. And I would reply, well, doesn't everybody? Anyway, the pants that I buy, over a period of years, of course, have either been made in Indonesia, Egypt, or Tunisia. They are never made in Lancashire anymore. Never made in Lancashire. That we are so dependent on buying this stuff from foreign countries is a direct result. None of this has happened, but somebody said earlier, none of this happens by accident. It's all been thought out and planned. The Dumbos, look, I admire the British, I admire the white race, we are wonderful people, but there's no doubt that over the years we've turned our brains off. There's no doubt we've turned our brains off. There's no doubt that we've got our brains in bloody neutral. There's no doubt about that. However, I have no doubt that we will solve every one of our problems. Now, how about that as a promise from the speaker? Right? Every problem will be solved. We've got a round of applause for that. You want to know how to get a round of applause? Just say, every problem will be solved. And I'm going to listen. I keep to my word. I'm going to tell you how we're going to solve these problems. Otherwise, I couldn't have come here. All this is a direct result of a process known as globalization. Yeah. Globalization is the deliberate destruction of frontiers, the deliberate destruction of protective trade barriers, the deliberate destruction of countries and nations, and ultimately races and peoples, of course. And yeah, that's part of it. Now, this is all a result of a decision taken here in London and in parallel in the United States of America during the time of the government of Margaret Thatcher and at the time of the presidency of Ronald Reagan. A decision was made to produce unlimited free trade worldwide. Unlimited free trade worldwide. And the City of London here and Wall Street in New York were liberalised, a process called liberalisation. In London, the phrase that they used colloquially was the Big Bang. And the City of London and Wall Street, New York, were allowed, encouraged, permitted, and definitely encouraged, to invest vast sums of money, British capital, US capital respectively, in the cheap labour countries of the Far East to employ the highly disciplined, and very, very cheap labour of those countries in China, South Korea, working for pennies in the pound. That's what it's all about, employing these highly disciplined Chinese, etc., working for pennies in the pound, cents in the dollar. If you like, I'll give you an example of my own experience in this. 40 years ago, because I think to myself, how do these things actually happen? Why do they happen? And how do they happen? And I'll tell you, 40 years ago, I was an engineering student. One of the most happiest times of my life, actually. Hard work, but most enjoyable. Engineering is wonderful. Only one thing more interesting, nationalist politics. Anyway, I was an engineering student. We used to have these lectures, and one day the lecturer had been a managing director of a major British car manufacturing company, Austin Morris, as they called themselves at the time, a British Leyland, and changed names. Anyway, this man, whose name was George Turnbull, a top engineer, came to us engineering students and said to us, words to this effect, boys, or however Harry addressed us, the future is in the Far East. We all looked, because it was all engineers are patriots. Engineers are patriots. All the other trash are the social scientists. The Marxists and all them. But us engineers, if that grammar is correct, we're all very patriotic. What was he talking about? And what he said was this. He said, we are going to set up brand new factories, state-of-the-art technology, greenfield sites in South Korea. We're going to build cars in South Korea. We thought, well, goodness me. Anyway, I've never forgotten that, because it's sort of stuck in my mind. The fact is, whether you know it or not, South Korea produces vastly more cars per year than Great Britain does, vastly more. That's all done with British money, British capital, British technology, and it's British engineers who set it up. Because engineers just love building things. They didn't really understand what they were doing, I suppose. They just love building things. Give them the machines and the factories, they just set to and they start doing it, you know. But there was the plan 40 years ago. And now, why don't they make Ford of Dagenham? Doesn't make any cars anymore. They make car engines, they don't make cars. British Leyland, all gone kaput. Do you know who owns the big British Leyland plant? No, it's now owned by the Chinese. But it's now owned by the Chinese. And who owns Volvo in Sweden?
Chinese.
The Chinese. And the biggest plant in Britain was a Longbridge plant in Birmingham?
Chinese
own it. Who owns Jaguar cars?
India.
India, correct.
And Land Rover.
Volvo's was once owned by Volkswagen, who I think bought it as a joke, actually.
The biggest container port in England, Felixstowe, is owned by the
Chinese.
The traitor, the family silver.
London Metal Exchange as well, man.
Yeah, a guy who calls himself Paul, Lord Paul, an Indian who calls himself Lord Paul. So, we are being destroyed, and I'm just talking about the financial aspect of all this.
Everything's fucking gone.
So, listen, I said when I came here, I'd give you the solution. Because I could not address these meetings, and I couldn't be a nationalist if I didn't know what the solution is. And the solution to all these financial problems, and the deindustrialization of the West, which is part of this problem, which is part of a deliberate part of this scheme of globalization, is the deindustrialization of the West, and the outsourcing of our jobs to the cheap labour countries of the cheap labour countries of the Far East. The solution is, to all these problems, is to be found in the application of the principles of economic nationalism. And this is my last sentence, because it gives a bit of time for questions or whatever, different views or your wrapping answers. The principles of economic nationalism are that we live within our means, that everything we need, that what we need, we build ourselves, and that we rebuild British industry, and we employ British people again. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.